Welcome to the podcast of this Brecan information session. Information sessions are recorded at the Brecan Resource Centre and can be borrowed in CD format from the Resource Library. Sessions are copyrighted and are for personal home use only. If you would like to know more about this and other sessions, please contact Brecan on 1300 781 500. We hope you enjoy this podcast. This session was recorded on the 25th of August 2014 at the Brecan Resource Centre, located in Melbourne CBD. Associate Professor Orla McNally is a gynecological oncologist and Director of Oncology and Dysplasia at the Women's Hospital. She is an advisor to Ovarian Cancer Australia, a member of the ANSCOG Clinical Trials Group, Deputy Chairperson of the Cancer Council Victoria Executive Group, and a lead player in the Victorian Comprehensive Cancer Centre Initiative. In this session, Orla speaks about the current state of treatment and research in the gynecological cancer field. We hope you find this session interesting.
Good morning, because it was like a very Irish day this morning, actually, leaving for work. But in true Melbourne style, the sun has come out, so I was able to hop on a tram to come down from the hospital. But I've still got it all as backup if I need it going back. I'm Orla McNally. I'm the head of the gyne-oncology unit at the Women's Hospital. And you'll see actually on the flyer that went around that I'm down as Miss Orla McNally, but I've actually had a little promotion since then. So, and that's been very special, because what Australia does, which is different to the UK and Ireland, is it acknowledges clinical professorships. And to me, that clinical word is very important, because it means that we're always very engaged in looking after patients and what's actually happening on the work floor, if you like.
So all clinical as opposed to
academic. Yeah. So, and that wouldn't have happened for me without the work of the team that I belong to, and also the work that I do with groups like Brecan, because big part of getting those professorships is advocacy and consumer engagement. So thank you, Brecan, for inviting me, and I hope all of you will get something out of this. I did ask just as I came in if I'm allowed to ask you what type of cancer you've had. And if that's okay, I'd like to, because gynecological cancer is actually a very big area. And I don't want to go off on a tangent in one particular area if no one in the room has had it, for example. So, okay, yep, a good idea. So I guess what I'll do by way of introduction, because so the most common one for us is uterine cancer. So who in the room has had uterine cancer? Okay. Next one down is ovarian. Right. Cervical cancer. Vulval cancer. Vaginal cancer? Any other cancer that they see as a gynecological cancer? Okay. So we've got the top three today then: uterine, ovary, and cervix. And if we look at gynecological cancers as that group, it's actually the third most common cause of cancer in women and the fourth most common cause of death. And that's really important, because people who look after you with a gynecological cancer, whether you've got uterine cancer or ovarian cancer, we're all the same team. So it's important that we have our knowledge and our expertise across the different sites. And in terms of our service delivery, it's exactly the same. So we've got to advocate in terms of all gynecological cancers, rather than trying to hone in on one particular area, because it's much more powerful to actually do that as a group of cancers. So one of the big advances in cancer care in the last three decades now has been the cropping up of multidisciplinary teams. And I've probably not actually listed everybody here, but what that actually means is that for any person diagnosed with a cancer, we would now hope these days that as a minimum standard of care, their diagnosis and their care will be determined by a discussion held by a multidisciplinary team. And the reason for that is that some of us are more up with the evidence than others, as there are different aspects that impact on care, and it's important that everybody is able to have their view And at the end of our meetings and at the end of each discussion, we want to be able to come to a consensus. So it's a group consensus on what is the best care for that woman. And very importantly, they're down at the end, but they're probably one of the most important groups because this really does influence what happens in terms of your care. Having the support, your psychosocial networks, your family networks. In an ideal world, we would also be able to engage you, the patient, as part of these discussions, but the logistics of that just now don't really allow that. But, you know, that's something that we have to aim to strive for in the future. So the other thing that has made a major impact on cancer care is clinical trials. Is everyone in the room aware of what a clinical trial is? Many of you have probably been involved in them. But we know what tends to work best because women previously have provided their time to go into clinical trials, which is where we maybe compare one treatment with another treatment, and we then look at the outcomes. And sometimes there's no difference between the two, but that's also really useful information. Occasionally, the treatment has been worse in the trial arm, but that's also very important information. And this just shows you that at the women's, where the national guidance on recruitment to trials is recommended to be about 10%, we actually got up to about 18% at in 2011-2012. And our main reason for that was because we have some support for research nurses, because without research nurses, we can't run our clinical trials. And very sadly, that support is all philanthropic. So it's not actually a core business for any organization to, or for many organizations at least, to fund your research nurses, even though it's a very, very important part of cancer care. I did have something on vulval cancer and vaginal cancer, but what I want to just point out on this one, because it's applicable to some of the other cancers that we'll talk about. One of the biggest morbidities in cancer is obviously related to the treatment. If you don't have to have an operation, you're unlikely to get complications, you're unlikely to get problems as a result of having treatment. For many cancers, the treatment of where the cancer is causes some problems, but it's often the other treatment, figuring out where the cancer has spread to, is what leads to the morbidity. And that is a very big issue in both vulval cancer and in uterine cancer. And the reason for that is because we have to assess what's happening in the lymph glands or the lymph nodes. So when you get a sore throat, you get sore glands up here. When you have a breast cancer, we need to know what's happening under the arm in these glands in here. When you have vulval cancer, they're in the groins here. When you have uterine or cervix cancer, they're in the pelvis, and similarly with ovarian cancer. And if you take those out, you interrupt the lymphatics, which regulate flow of lymph and help with infection control throughout the body. And the downside is you can get lymphedema, which is swelling of one or both legs, which for women who just have had to have the lymph glands removed, the risk of that is about 30%. If you have to have radiotherapy on top of it, it's almost 100%. And so one of the big advances for trying to deal with this problem, is there anything special about the lymph glands that we can do so that we minimize the morbidity associated with the treatment? And this is called sentinel lymph node technology. So in any group of lymph glands, whether it's in your neck, whether it's under the arm, whether it's in the pelvis, they're in a group. And you've got a principal one here at the beginning, and it's the sentinel. So it's the soldier standing at the gate, and it's saying, I'm on guard, and if the cancer cell doesn't come through me, it's not going to go to the other lymph glands. So there's been an awful lot of work trying to identify that sentinel node so that you only have to take that one out. And if that's negative for cancer, then the others are very unlikely to be affected. And that means that the risk then of something like lymphedema is very, very reduced. So This is supported by evidence. And just again using vulval cancer as an example, there are two very big studies here on the right. They always have very fancy names, these. So look, the second one there is called the groin study, you know. It's actually the Groningen removal of lymph nodes in cancer of the vulva. Don't quite know where the acronym came from, all of that, but... what that has shown is that if you identify the sentinel lymph node, then it's highly predictive of all of the other lymph nodes being negative. And this is now used as a standard in breast cancer, in vulval cancer, and in growing numbers in cervical cancer. I will emphasize that it is just on small cancers, so cancers less than 4 centimeters, because once you get beyond that, the predictability of it may not be as good. And how we identify those nodes is that you have the most common technique that's used is a little blue dye is injected around the cancer, whether that's in the breast, in the vulva, or in the cervix. And then when we start to do the operation, we can see the blue dye has traveled, and it goes to the first lymph node, and it shows up as a blue lymph node that's removed, and that's the sentinel lymph node. So this is a really one of the big advances in cancer surgery in the last decade. Sorry, I'll skip back on there. I didn't put up too many medical pictures, okay? And Lee's already cringing because I've got very few pictures like this because, you know, I might like looking at them, but you know, it's not everyone's cup of tea. But the reason I put this up is that can look like a normal cervix. Women don't really know what their cervix looks like, and actually a lot of GPs also don't know what a normal cervix looks like. So we often just get a lot of women being referred query abnormal cervix, even though they've had a normal pap smear. Because there are a lot of variations in how the cervix looks, and a lot of ones that can look a bit abnormal, actually majority of them turn out to look normal. Now, in the Western world, screening for cervical cancer is one of the big success stories. It's known to have reduced the incidence and the death rate from cervical cancer. And if you have a robust screening program like we have in Australia, then it's estimated that 93% of cancers will be preventable. But with any screening program, there are limitations. And this may be because we use pap smears for cervical cancer. It may be that the pap smear hasn't been taken correctly. It may be that the person reading it hasn't identified the abnormality, although these are highly trained people. But even then, there's a reporting error of up to 20%. We do know that even with screening programs, currently it's every 2 years in Australia, you might still get cancers that pop up in between those 2 years. And although the most common type of cancer of the cervix is squamous cell cancer, about 10% of cervical cancers are a different cell type, which more comes from the glands than from the surface cells, and that's an adenocarcinoma. And pap smears, if they pick up that type of cancer, that's more through luck than through design. And of course, the most important thing about screening is you got to pitch up and have it done. If you don't turn up and have a pap test, then it's not going to work, is it? So, awful lot of talk about human papillomavirus these days in the community. I have to emphasize that, and this is what we tried to talk to women about, it is as common as the common cold. And once women become sexually active, 80% of them will carry HPV, human papillomavirus, in the vagina. There are over 100 types, but there are, in the Western world, there are probably just 2, maybe 4, that are associated with the development of cervical cancer. And what happens with this virus is that women, the most likely time they contract the virus is during first sexual experiences. But if you see down here, 80% of this type of infection will actually go away again. About 15% it persists, And less than 5% of all of those infections has the potential to turn into cancer. So, you know, we've got to address those issues that women have about a viral infection and its association with cancer. But over here, the likelihood of getting cancer from it is really very, very small. But there's a lot of distress associated with this whole thing of HPV because women are worried that their partners are cheating on them. But we know that you can get HPV infection from one sexual encounter. Even if the infection appears to have gone away, it can become reactivated because it actually always stays in the cells. So if a woman's been with her partner for 30 years and then suddenly pops up a positive HPV test, it's more likely reactivation of that virus rather than any new infection. And so this is a good diagram that shows the broad breadth of what HPV does, but then it goes right up to that pointy end, translating into, for a country of this size, a relatively small number of deaths from cervical cancer, given the high infection rate down at the end. But in between here, you've got an enormous group of women who still have to go through the morbidity of having treatment for HPV-related diseases. So it's a very important health issue. It has been for Australia. And but Australia has also led the way in terms of how we manage this infection. I think I've got my slides a little bit mixed up here. Yes, because I just wanted to talk about the HPV vaccination. So this vaccine was developed by Ian Fraser, who, as many of you know, got the Australian of the Year award. He's actually a Scot originally, but, you know, thought that's nothing new for Australia. So he developed the HPV vaccination, which all our girls now get coming through year 12. And this is a vaccine that is against the HPV types that are most likely associated with cervical cancer. There are two vaccines on the market. One is called Gardasil, the other is called Cervarix. Unfortunately, it's been promoted as the cervical cancer vaccine. And I think that's been a big mistake because it actually doesn't necessarily prevent all cervical cancer. And many women have taken that as, I don't need to go and have pap smears anymore, even if I've been vaccinated, which is a real education problem for us. So Cervarix just had the is against the HPV type 16 and 18. So 16 and 18 are the types most likely to be associated with cervical cancer in the Western world. And but in Gardasil, they put in two extra, which were 6 and 11. Now, 6 and 11 are the HPV types associated with genital warts. And already, in studies done in Melbourne, genital warts have almost disappeared. Absolutely amazing. But in the UK, because Cervarix cut a deal with the government for a cheaper vaccination program, so UK women get Cervarix, not Gardasil. So if we see genital warts in Australia, it'll probably be British people coming in from outside. So interesting. And just this month, The Lancet, which is one of the biggest impact journals in the world, has shown through evidence from Victoria that there has been a significant reduction in the incidence of precancer abnormalities of the cervix as a result of vaccination program. And not only that, that there has been a reduction in women who haven't been vaccinated. So this is something called herd immunity, which means that a vaccine which has been given to lots of women has had an impact on the health of other women in a very, very positive way. And men, by the way. So boys are vaccinated now too. So just one final thing with HPV. We now understand it so well that the pap smear or the screening program is actually going to change in a couple of years in Australia. And instead of having a pap smear, a woman will go to her GP and have, it's a similar type of test, but instead of it picking up cells, it's actually going to be a test for HPV. If the HPV test is negative, that's highly predictive of no cervical abnormality at that time. It's even more predictive than a negative pap smear. If the HPV test is positive, that same sample will be sent off to have a smear done on it. And if that is positive, then the woman will be sent and referred on for colposcopy, which is a further examination of the cervix. The epidemiological data is so strong for this that the HPV test only needs to be done every 5 years. So not every 2 years like it is currently. And not only that, in women who never pitch up for screening, they'll actually be sent a self-testing kit. So if it's a real reluctance on the behalf of women to go and see a healthcare provider to have a pap smear, they'll get a kit to do it at home. Now that's a bit of a research thing just yet, but it's better than nothing. You can see where we are, right down here, but you can see as a burden of disease how huge it is for the rest of the world still, and how then the impact of a vaccination program might be in other parts of the world as well. And that's what I said down the bottom. Even if you've been vaccinated, you've got to still go there and have your screening done. So we know that it tends to have a bimodal distribution cervical cancer, but still the average age is around 52. Many will be picked up on a pap smear, but other women, it's presenting with abnormal bleeding, abnormal discharge, abnormal-looking cervix. And unfortunately, we still do see women with advanced disease, and they're presenting where already the disease has caused blockage of the drainage tubes from the kidneys. So that's really quite alarming still to be seeing that. On the right side are the risk factors for it, and that is all tied up with, again, the HPV exposure. But this isn't unique to every woman who has cervical cancer. So the treatment options are surgery and radiotherapy. And chemotherapy is normally now given with radiotherapy. And in terms of outcome for cervical cancer, that's one of the things that has made a major, major impact in the past 20 years, better than any other treatment for prior to that. So when we talk about surgery, it's not just a simple hysterectomy and taking out those lymph glands. We actually aim to take out the supporting tissue of the cervix, which is this area here. And as a result, this can affect bladder function and rectal function more. But it does mean that for younger women, they may retain their ovaries, and there are other side effects of radiotherapy. Every woman with cervical cancer could be treated with radiotherapy and chemotherapy. The outcome is as good as for surgery, but if you have a small early cancer, then we wouldn't want to give the additional morbidity of radiotherapy or take away ovarian function and render a woman menopausal before time. So another advance that has sort of happened in the last 10 years is women with early cervix cancer, is it actually necessary for them to lose their uterus as part of their treatment? And there are now many cases of women around the world who've just had the cervix and the supporting tissue and the lymph glands removed. And this, just taking the cervix, is called a trachelectomy. So this bit here is removed, and then the uterus is attached to the vagina. And there are many pregnancies and deliveries that have happened as a result of this advanced type of surgery. But women have to be obviously appropriately counseled, because there can be problems just trying to get pregnant, and they have to be closely monitored in pregnancy, obviously, because there's a big risk of premature delivery. And needless to say, women need to be delivered by cesarean section, because there is no cervix to dilate to allow for a normal labor. So moving on to ovarian cancer, and again, you know, we're all aware there's an awful lot to talk about with any of these cancers, and I'm happy to take questions at the end, obviously. I'm trying to focus in just on where I think that we've had the big wins in these cancers in the last couple of decades. And ovarian cancer has... We've learned a huge amount in relation to this disease, really, in the last 5 to 10 years. I'm not sure that it has quite translated into being able to improve the outcomes from it just yet, but I think we're on a trajectory like this, just like happened for breast cancer. For breast cancer, we're now much more familiar with the different types. There are about 9 subtypes of breast cancer, and each of those subtypes has a different type of treatment. And as a result, the outcomes for women with breast cancer have been enormously changed. And of course, what's at the back end of all of that? That's the research and the investment in research. And because ovarian cancer is a less common cancer, it hasn't had the same investment to date, but we're getting there. We're getting there. And particularly in Melbourne, there's a huge amount going on in Melbourne in researching ovarian cancer. So I'm going to just talk a little bit about these three things, but before I do, the problem with ovarian cancer, and many of you may have experienced this, is it doesn't give, it's taught not to give a lot of symptoms, but I'll show you some evidence that suggests that that might not be the case. But the problem is that perimenopausally, when it's most likely to occur, the symptoms that it does produce are very similar to those that tend to happen around the menopause anyway in relation to reduced hormone circulation and conditions like irritable bowel syndrome, weight gain, etc. What we do know is that up to 15% of ovarian cancers arise as a result of a mutation in one of the genes called the BRCA gene. And BRCA stands for breast cancer gene. And if this is carried by a woman, then she has a significantly increased lifetime risk of developing ovarian cancer. So if the general lifetime risk is about 14 per 1,000, that goes right up to almost 400 per 1,000. And somewhat unfortunately, you all probably saw the stuff about Angelina Jolie, and she was having her breasts removed. So here's the woman from Tomb Raiders. You know, the men all loved her strutting her stuff with the big boobs. She was going to be having them removed because when you carry the BRCA mutation, your lifetime risk of developing breast cancer is up to 60%. So many women elect to have their breasts removed to take away that risk. But what didn't come to light in all of the media studies was she discovered that she had the BRCA gene mutation because her mother died of ovarian cancer. And it would have been a good thing to just get out there in the media as well. So there's a particular type of ovarian cancer, which is the most common one, called serous cancer. And now all women who are diagnosed with this as a standard, we would recommend that they're seen in a familial cancer clinic and counseled about having genetic testing, because it might have implications for them if it is positive in relation to developing breast cancer, in relation to other members of their family, and also in relation to what treatments might be available to them, which have a different effect compared to someone who doesn't carry the BRCA mutation. In Australia, we have about 1,300 cases diagnosed per year, with nearly half as many deaths. And why is this? Well, because 75% of cases the disease has left the pelvis before a diagnosis is made. And this is extremely relevant because stage refers to how far your cancer has gone from where it actually started. So if a cancer is just in the ovaries, for example, it's stage 1. But if it has gone from there up into the abdominal area up here, it's already stage 3 of 4 possible stages. So why are we beginning to learn a lot more about this? And I think David Botell has come to talk to this group, and he does this much more eloquently than me, but Yeah, he mentions it in certain circles, I think. But no, it's a really nice story. So the Australian Ovarian Cancer Study was conceived by David Botell, who's the head of cancer research at Peter Mac. But also he did that with Dorota Gertig, who works with the Victorian Cytology Service on cervical screening. She's an epidemiologist. And they put their heads together. They were looking for funding. And the US Defense were funding cancer projects. They could come from anywhere. But the important thing was to get it onto the right paper when you did your submission. And we use A4 in Australia for most things. I think they use A3 or something. So it was even down to that detail, so that they wouldn't recognize where the actual application came from. I'm also told that on the day of the deadline, they were chasing the FedEx van up Flemington Road as it headed to the airport to get it in. So, but anyway, it got up and it got funded. And it was a collaboration, it still is, a collaboration between clinician scientists, patients and advocacy groups. And what it basically allowed was for information to be collected on over 2,500 women over a period of time on their diagnosis, their treatment, their risk factors, anything at all that could be collected. Each of these women signed up to it. They provided, I don't know if any of you in the room did, but they signed up to providing samples of their own cancer, samples of fluid that can accumulate, particularly when disease comes back. And women still do that today. So the bank of information is constantly being added to. And it has allowed us then to put all that information together to look at different things. And not only that, but researchers from around the world can apply to AOCS saying, I've got a particular question that I want to answer. I've got the means to do that, but I need the samples. I need the information. And AOCS have a very open policy about that. So it's just been a massive bank of information to be able to do that. And so one of the studies that I'd like to share with you, which the Queensland Institute of Research did, was about, well, what are the myths about ovarian cancer? And three of the big ones were, it doesn't cause symptoms, it takes a long time to diagnose, and women see many doctors. And if you could diagnose it quickly, and if we could catch it at an early stage, would survival improve? So looking at symptoms, well, these are the common symptoms listed. And women with cancer, yes, many of them had these symptoms, but they also looked at women who didn't have cancer. And many of the women who didn't have cancer also had symptoms. And that just gives you an idea how difficult it can be for GPs to decide, you know, which woman should I send for an ultrasound, for further investigation. The second one was, if it takes a long time, and do I need to see lots of doctors? And this just gives you the interaction of this group of women. So about 60% of women might have seen a number of doctors before they were diagnosed, but actually when you looked at this in a bit more detail, the majority of women got their diagnosis on the third doctor. So again, that's important, and that's the specialist when you get to the third doctor there. But it's still sobering that, you know, some women needed to see 6, even 12 specialists before they, or 12 doctors, had 12 interactions with a medical practitioner before the diagnosis was made. So, you know, we do have some work to do on that. This shows that women presenting with symptoms and the time to diagnosis. So up to 24 months on the bottom line here. And the different colors are whether it was early stage, stage 1-2, late stage, stage 3-4. It's got a borderline group in there. So borderline ovarian cancers are ones which, when you look down the microscope, they've got some features of cancer, but not enough to call them a true cancer, and certainly not enough to warrant having other treatments like chemotherapy. But what this is showing, that actually didn't matter what stage your disease was, for some women it could actually take quite a long time to get the diagnosis. And that's just illustrating it by percentage-wise. But what this did actually disprove was that women with ovarian cancer do get plenty of symptoms. It doesn't necessarily take a long time to get to diagnosis. And just because you've taken a long time to get a diagnosis doesn't mean your cancer won't be early. So it might still be early. So based on some of that information, I'm sorry this doesn't project very well, Ovarian Cancer Australia developed an app which is down for downloading to an iPhone or an Android, and it was invested in by David Davis, our current health minister. And what this is a symptom diary that you can use on your phone, because often what is hard for us as women is thinking, oh, I've had that pain, but actually did it start a month ago? Did it start 2 months ago? You know, I've been so busy. So this is a way of recording symptoms, and there's little prompts there to say, okay, this has been going on a bit. You actually need to go and see your doctor now. So it's not been produced with any evidence to prove that it has an impact. But again, you know, what we do see is women who, some women will go to see their doctor for the smallest of symptoms, and other women it'll take them an awful long time. So if it gives women that power to do something sooner, then hopefully that will translate into a good impact. I just want to mention something about CA125. Again, those of you in the room who've gone through treatment for ovarian cancer will be quite aware of this. And it's also out there, as women often see their doctors every year for, I'm going to have my ovarian cancer check. Well, there actually isn't any screening for ovarian cancer. But they'll have a pelvic ultrasound and they'll have a blood test. And it's normal, so that's reassuring. But actually, it's only reassuring at that point in time. It doesn't tell you anything about what's going to happen down the track. And there's been many studies done through the United Kingdom, another one about to report at the end of the year, using this blood test and ultrasound to see if it's useful in detecting cancer. But the studies so far have, all they've shown is that the number of women who've undergone an unnecessary intervention has been far too high to justify it as a screening tool. So in other words, at the moment, it causes more harm than good. And the reason why it's difficult is that this blood test can become abnormal in many conditions. So it can be even a bit of menstruation where blood goes back into the pelvis that can cause the blood test to become abnormal. And there are other non-gynecological conditions that can cause the test to be abnormal as well. So it always has to be interpreted with caution. There are some other ones on the market like HE4 and Ovplex. They cost, so women will sign up to having these done. The HE4 is $40. I don't know what Ovplex currently is. But again, not good enough to be in general use. So where are we at with treatment of ovarian cancer? Well, the mainstay of treatment is surgery and chemotherapy. Radiotherapy has a role in some situations, and mainly still through clinical trials, some what we call novel therapies, which are the newer agents coming on the market, have some role. We also use hormonal therapies in ovarian cancer. So tamoxifen, which is very commonly used in the treatment of breast cancer, does have a role in some situations in ovarian cancer. And increasingly personalized medicine. So that's referring, an example of that is doing the BRCA testing and seeing if women have that mutation or not, because that might influence what treatments are going to be available for them. So what does surgery involve? Well, it actually, as a basic rule, what we're trying to do is figure out what the stage of the cancer is. So I talked about stage a bit earlier. Now, it may be obvious when we start an operation that it is already at an advanced stage, but if it's just something early in the ovaries, we want to confirm that it's just early. So what that involves is at the beginning of surgery, we put some wash inside the tummy, we suck that out, and that gets sent away to be examined to see if there are any cancer cells in there. Then if a woman is not wanting to preserve her fertility, she'll have, you know, there's another acronym, THBSO, means the uterus, the tubes and ovaries are removed. Then we sample some of the lymph nodes, which for ovarian cancer, the relevant ones are in the pelvis. They're up around the major blood vessel called the aorta. There's a fat pad that hangs down off the omentum here. It's called, off the bowel. It's called the omentum, sometimes referred to as the policeman of the abdomen, because when you've got things like appendicitis, it just moves to that area and walls it off until someone deals with it. But it is one of the first things to become affected when cancer cells leave the ovaries and travel to other parts. And then we take little biopsies all around inside to check if there's any sign of spread. And it's only then can we establish what the true stage of the cancer is. There are the big problem with ovarian cancer is that it doesn't have to get very big for it to leave the organs where it has started. So for it to leave the ovaries and to start to go to other surfaces inside the tummy. And the reason for that is there's actually a bit of a circular motion going on inside the abdomen. So we all have a little bit of fluid there. It's been scientifically worked out that it moves in a clockwise direction. That doesn't matter whether you're in the northern hemisphere or the southern hemisphere. And so the cells from the cancer can travel and deposit themselves on other surfaces along the way. So up under the diaphragm, the right diaphragm is more often affected than the left diaphragm. And why does it do that? Well, everything inside here is covered with a surface covering. It's a bit like glad wrap. And the cancer cells can take up residence on any of those surfaces. So we have to check all of those surfaces to see if they're affected. And where it's safe and possible to do so, that's what surgery will do. Another way I sometimes use to describe it, it's a bit like, and I'm always a bit cautious doing this because you'll never want to eat Victoria sponge again, but when you make a cake and you take your lovely icing sugar and you sprinkle it over the top, well, if you take a tiny bit, you get a tiny bit. If you keep going, it starts to cover a lot of the surfaces. And that is how ovarian cancer leaves the pelvis and moves to other areas. Unlike other cancers, which tend to just travel in the blood and they go to a particular organ, maybe the liver, maybe the lungs. So the kind of procedures we might need to do then to remove all of this disease are taking it from under the diaphragms, removing the lymph glands, removing the omentum. And it may be that we need to do even bigger surgeries to remove all of the disease that we can see. So it sometimes requires liver type of surgery, bowel resection, maybe opening the chest. So that means we may need to involve other disciplines. Although, in our experience as gynae-oncologists, the non-gynecological specialists who we involve for this type of disease, they don't actually ever see this disease in their discipline. So it's quite difficult for them to get their head around it, but that's why we work in teams, obviously. And that's why it's probably really good that we try to develop the expertise as much as we can ourselves. But in order to achieve all of this, then it's going to require longer operating times, longer possibly admission to intensive care. And obviously women need to accept that this is big surgery. It's going to be long. It might have complications. And even in the best of hands, it can result in death as a result of the surgery. Why is this so important? Well, we used to think that we were doing pretty good if we went in and we took out as much disease as we could, but we maybe left a few spots here and there. And we used to feel that getting down to, you know, half a centimetre here and there, that was fine because the chemo is going to come along and it's going to map up all the rest. But actually, there's a lot of evidence showing now that the more you get your disease out, the more it translates into long-term survival. So surgical effort to get down to no disease is very important. And the reason why this is thought to be the case is that if you leave little areas behind, it can become resistant to the chemotherapy that you use. And that's what's going to start to grow down the track. So when I said that one of the big advances was this understanding that the role of surgery is vital, that's where we're at. The other thing that's happened is, like the breast cancer story, we have discovered that it's a whole bunch of diseases, ovarian cancer. This is the ovary in the center here, and around the edge there you see little follicles. That gives rise to the most common type of ovarian cancer, which is epithelial cancer. And the middle section, which is the supporting tissue, that gives rise to a less common type of ovarian cancer, which is non-epithelial cancer. This is quite different because more often than not, it is at an early stage. It's actually highly curable. So I'm going to concentrate on the left side for a bit. Within that epithelial ovarian cancer, we now know, based on David Botell's work, that there are two subtypes in here. And within the subtypes, there are lots of other types. I talked about the serous cancer, and that's the one that is the most common. And so it's beginning to look a bit like this. It's not just one bunch of diseases that are exactly the same, that it can all be treated the same. But it's more like a bowl of fruit, and we need to figure out which fruit we're actually dealing with. And that comes down to the whole world of genomics and molecular profiling of tumors, which is getting right down to that cellular level to see exactly what it is that's different about each cancer. And so if you take what we thought was everyone was blue before, you now break it up and this is just one type of ovarian cancer. So the colors here represent the different types of serous ovarian cancer. The colors here represent, in breast and renal, the similarities between these cancers. So they might come from a different organ, but at molecular level, they actually have very similar features. And what that then tells us is that down the track, we may actually be talking about a specific cancer because it shares genetic information, it shares molecular information that's very similar, and that's what will determine how we treat it, rather than it's come from the ovary, it's come from the breast, it's come from the kidney. Just finally, because it's something, again, that you may have heard of or be familiar with, there is, within, again, the more common type, the serous cancer, there has been a theory emerging that this type of cancer may arise in the fallopian tubes, then go onto the surface of the ovary and leave from there. So as a strategy to reduce the risk of ovarian cancer, many women now, when they're having a hysterectomy for maybe heavy periods, they'll consent to having their tubes removed as well. The ovaries will be left behind. Women who are known to be at high risk of ovarian cancer, it's very important that they not just have their ovaries removed, but they have the tubes removed as well. But again, it's probably just one subtype that has this tubal theory of origin. So our chemotherapy is the next bit of the armamentarium. And the most standard treatment is combination of drugs, carboplatin and paclitaxel. Again, I emphasized earlier in my talk that if we can do that at all within the realms of a clinical trial, it's really good. And this is where some of the newer agents such as Avastin, which you might have heard talk of in the press as well, this has been worked out to benefit a certain group of women. So not everyone's going to benefit from it, but again, a certain group. And this is the next little problem with ovarian cancer, because most ovarian cancer is really sensitive to chemotherapy and it makes the cancer disappear. But many women will develop resistant cells, whether at the time or down the track, and the cancer starts to grow again. But the chemotherapy doesn't seem to work in the same way. And that's because down again at cellular level, mechanisms have emerged which make the cancer cells resistant to the effects of the chemotherapy. So there are some trials, again, trying to use new molecules which switch off that resistance so that the cells will become sensitive again. Because if you could actually do that, you would turn ovarian cancer into a chronic disease where you need some treatment now and you might need it again a few years later. Like many of the other, particularly the blood-borne malignancies, they are often managed like that. So if we could figure out resistance, then we'd get a long way to helping manage the disease as well. And I meant to add it in the subsequent treatments, but one of the other emerging things now is the whole area of our immunity and how we deal with cancer, and the development of vaccines. So this is going to open up wide up in the next few years, where once you've had a cancer, a vaccine is developed against your particular form of cancer. So that once you've completed your treatment, you're in remission, you get a vaccine, and hopefully that will prevent the cancer growing again. So that's a big space to watch. So moving on to I've left the most common cancer till last, uterine cancer, which is rising in incidence and significantly so. And sadly, this is because of our rising obesity problem. And the UK have actually just published statistics on this and shown that it is specifically the rising obesity rates that have led to the rise in uterine cancer. But fortunately, you see on this side here, if we look at stage again, most of these cancers are at an early stage and are highly curable. Most women present with bleeding, particularly after the menopause, and we still have to get the message out to women that if you get bleeding after the menopause, you've got a 1 in 10 chance that there's a cancer there. So it always has to be investigated. For younger women, it might be that they are having a regular bleeding or in both groups, vaginal bleeding. And many women are on tamoxifen. And we know that tamoxifen can affect the lining of the womb in many ways. But in the absence of bleeding, there doesn't tend to be pathology there. So the advice is any bleeding on tamoxifen must be investigated. The risk factors, well, number one is obesity. Family history, and that's along with some other cancers, which I'll mention in a minute. Many women take hormone replacement therapy. And when hormone replacement therapy first came out, women were actually prescribed estrogen by itself. But there are two elements to hormone replacement therapy if you have a uterus. One is the estrogen, which gives you all the good stuff. The progesterone protects the lining of the womb. Because if you take estrogen only, it just stimulates the lining of the womb, and that can lead to abnormality. So it's very important that it's combined. Hypertension and diabetes, they may be tied up with the whole obesity syndrome, and may just be surrogates, but they're sort of seen still as risk factors. Why is the obesity rate, or why is it obesity is the problem? Well, the more fat you have, the more peripheral conversion you have in the fat of substances which raise your level of estrogen. And so more estrogen you've got circulating, the more estrogen there is to stimulate the lining of the uterus, and that leads to either pre-cancer or to cancer. We've not been terribly good in Australia at providing what we call one-stop clinics. And again, I think this is work we've got to do with Breakin and our other advocacy groups, because that diagram, we've actually got someone working on it at the moment, that diagram I showed you for women with ovarian cancer who have all these interactions before they get a diagnosis. For uterine cancer, it can often be even greater. So they see their GP, he says, oh, not too worried, come back and see me. They go to the hospital, yeah, you probably need a scan. They get a scan, they come back for another appointment. Yes, you need to have an examination under anesthetic. They have their admission for their examination, brought back to clinic for results. You've got a cancer, back to see your specialist. That's actually eight fingers I've counted just there. Whereas with one-stop clinics, a woman with those symptoms is seen in the clinic. She has a transvaginal scan. If it's in any way abnormal, a sample is taken there and then. Results back, you know, within the week. And then the next appointment is with a specialist to talk about cancer treatment. Like all of the other cancers, we've discovered that there are different types of uterine cancer as well. The majority fall into the type 1 group, which is associated mainly with the obesity question. Those women tend to have a very favorable outcome. There is a smaller group. They have what are called type 2 cancers, where the grade of the cancer, which is the differentiation, so it looks more nasty down the microscope, more likely to have left the uterus by the time of diagnosis, and so the prognosis for them is poorer. And not surprising, that comes down to what's happening at molecular level, and these are just the abnormalities which are different in the different types of tumors. So what about prevention? Well, weight reduction is going to be key. A very nice study out of the UK that I saw at a meeting there recently, they looked at all women attending a bariatric unit for weight reduction, and they assessed their endometrium. So these were women who didn't have any symptoms or anything. 19% of them actually had an abnormality, both pre-cancer and cancer. So the women with cancer went on to have hysterectomies, but the women with pre-cancer abnormalities were going on to have their weight reduction program, whether it was surgery, exercise, or diet. And having their lap banding surgery was the quickest way to get reversal of the endometrial abnormality. So we've got to recognize the risk. And I think that's equally important in our younger women. It's actually quite hard as a care provider when a woman comes in and she's very overweight, she's got a uterine cancer, and then the family members come in and they're all very overweight as well, and you're going, ooh, you know, where's the boundary here? Can we advocate for this group coming along, because they've actually got the opportunity to do something about the problem. So polycystic ovarian syndrome is very common, and it was quite sad to see that there's a polycystic ovarian syndrome organization in Australia, and they produced a big document a few years ago on how to manage PCOS. No mention of their increased risk of uterine cancer in that document whatsoever. There are probably some things we can do. So a Myrina is an intrauterine contraceptive device that has a hormonal coating on it, which suppresses the lining of the womb. So it's a very good thing to use for women who have either PCOS or who are overweight. And metformin, which is used for treating diabetes, even used by itself, has been shown to reduce the incidence of and death rate from endometrial cancer. And IBIS trials, these are the International Breast Intervention Studies. So these are the studies that have educated us on what is the best treatment for the different types of breast cancer. So they're going to be starting a trial which is using the drug metformin to see if that reduces breast cancer rates. And one of the other outcomes of the study will be to see if it reduces endometrial cancer rates as well. So our standard surgery... Yeah, that's my second only surgical picture up there. and it's not very big, is it? But our standard surgery for uterine cancer is you remove the uterus, the tubes and the ovaries, and the pelvic lymph nodes may or may not need to be removed depending on the features of the cancer that's in the uterus. And a big advance in the management, surgical management of women with this tumour has been using keyhole surgery, so laparoscopic surgery. Well, you bounce back very easily. So traditionally, for open surgery, women who are not exceedingly overweight would be in hospital maybe 3 or 4 days. Women who are overweight and have open surgery, longer stay in hospital, higher incidence of infection, wound infection, slower return to work. But these are two big studies. The LAY study was done in Australia and the other one done in America. And it showed that the outcomes for women having their surgery by keyhole for this type of cancer were much, much better. So most of our women, they come in on the day of surgery. They stay 2 nights in hospital and home again. Much less pain. I can tell you that the pain is transferred from the patient to the surgeon because this surgery is not easy. But having said that, open surgery on very large ladies is not easy either. So this is why the robot might be something for the future, but if someone wants to ask me about that later, that's fine. women who are thought to be at high risk of their uterine cancer coming back based on the pathological examination of the uterus after their surgery are advised to have radiotherapy usually, and sometimes chemotherapy. And this has been informed by many international studies, but it is actually something that remains controversial. So although this is our most common cancer, we still don't know for sure what's the best type of treatment that they should have afterwards. And this question will only be answered with clinical trials. So our standard follow-up for women with uterine cancer is to see them for 5 years with a clinical review, do a vaginal examination. We don't do smears from the top of the vagina anymore. There's no evidence that that's any good at picking up disease coming back. If it does come back, radiotherapy can usually work. But if it's not just in the pelvic area where radiotherapy can be used, then treatment really is based on symptoms, because it's very unlikely that you're going to cure uterine cancer that's actually come back in other places. Having said that, we do not address the main reasons why this woman might have developed this cancer in the first place with our current follow-up program. And so together with BRECAN and the group called WICMIX, which are the Integrated Cancer Center Services for the Western Metropolitan Area, we've just had some funding for a program where we're trying to address the right side of the slide here. And so the background to this is that most women with uterine cancer have early disease. It will be cured with cancer. No evidence that routine checkups are any good at picking up the disease coming back. Most of the problems that women have, they tend to have it in between visits. And that can sometimes mean that they'll say, oh, I'll ignore this because I've actually got my checkup in a month's time, whereas we'd quite like them to go and see their doctor there and then. We don't address the comorbidities, and it's always anxiety-provoking every time you come for that checkup. So We are engaging in a program where we'll do an intense interview with the woman and a specialist nurse after we've decided that they're suitable for this, and then we engage with the GP to focus on a care plan that's going to address their other issues. Because the truth about uterine cancer for most women is they are extremely unlikely to die from this cancer. They're much more likely to die from diabetes-related conditions, heart disease, that sort of thing. I'm nearly there. How are we doing for time? Yep. Just a quick show of hands maybe. How many in the room have had the opportunity or it's been appropriate to go to a familial cancer clinic?
Okay, I thought it would probably be about half,
but I think that just reflects something in practice that has evolved over the last few years as well. And so as part of looking after a woman and treating the cancer, we've also got to identify, is this a cancer that's occurred out of the blue, which most cancers will have, or is this because there has been an inherited reason why this might have happened for this woman? And it's relevant for cancers that arise in the ovary or the fallopian tube. It's relevant for uterine cancer, probably not for cervix cancer or vulva or vagina. I've already talked about BRCA and what we do to help with that. So it's very important that when we do take the tubes and ovaries out for women to prevent this cancer, that the surgery is performed by someone with the background knowledge as to why this is happening, and that the pathology, so the examination of the tubes and ovaries, is by someone also with a special interest because it's done in a particular way. Because you can sometimes actually find cancer at that point. So Lynch syndrome is the other one relevant to gynecological cancers. So this was described by Lynch as clusters of cancers occurring in families, mainly colorectal, but 20 to 60% chance of uterine cancer. And if for these families, uterine cancer is often the first cancer in the family. So it's very important for us to pick up on that. And at the time of doing the pathological examination of the uterus, there's a couple of extra tests that we can do, which aren't diagnostic of a genetic problem, but they might sort of suggest that there might be. So we would send someone on to have further information gathered. But in this group, the other cancers that are at increased risk are gastric, stomach, and ovarian cancer as well. It's also referred to as hereditary non-polyposis colon cancer, HNPCC, but they're part of the same thing. And it arises because you've got genes which are normally involved in repairing defects. There's a mismatch in them, so they've got mutations. And I've talked about screening. So what do we do then with a woman at risk? So family history is key. Although even with a good family history, because not everyone has an extended family that it will give you the information, or sometimes someone comes from a very big family and you think there's a cluster of cancers there, but actually it's because there's a very big family. And so we would recommend that someone's seen in a familial cancer clinic, because genetic testing has implications. Got implications for your siblings, for other family members, for yourself, and so doing it with genetic counselors is very, very important so that people understand the implications of having the test. Thank you very much. I should say, not that we know of not presently, because there's a little bit of early data coming out that So for the BRCA mutation, there are two types. There's type 1 and type 2. And in type 2, it's thought there's maybe a higher incidence of a particular uterine cancer, which is serous papillary cancer. So that's a rarer type of uterine.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. You can subscribe to Breakhands podcasts or browse existing ones at our website, www.breakhand.org.au.